whatever. But the author of the Apocalypse was telling us a story very much more complicated than that of the apostles and the disciples. Yet there is a definite indication in the Apocalypse that the author was indebted to St. Paul. Although, generally speaking, the writings of John belong to a little different group, and John and Peter and Paul never got along well together. Actually, the Apocalypse is one of the most difficult books in the world to interpret. The reason being that it is an intense polyglot and derives a confusion of emblems and symbols from a number of other sources. As early as the 3rd century, it was alleged that the Apocalypse had been influenced by Hindu and Far Eastern doctrines, and many of the early writers felt its indebtedness to the Persian mysteries. Certainly, the Apocalypse was a product of this melting pot of beliefs. It was a syncretic work. And if we could imagine ourselves today, with our present perspective, in a world such as that in which the Apocalypse was written, we would say that it was a work on comparative religion, that it was definitely created to bind up the wounds which had divided the faiths of the past, and in a way to archly intimate that Christianity was the summation of the spiritual convictions of man and not a new religion. I think this is one of the strongest points that is held in the overtones of the Apocalypse. The writer is trying to tell us that all prophecies, all mysteries, all great systems of ancient ritual and doctrine were fulfilled in the Christian dispensation, and that the Christian Messiah was the one whose coming and whose rulership over the quick and the dead had been promised since the beginning of time. This means one of two things, and there's a little question here, but the answers are reasonably probable. In the first place, it could be that certain changes were made in the Book of Revelation, by which it was tied to Christianity and that it was not actually a Christian writing. This, however, seems a little doubtful. It seems more likely that the author carried this miscellaneous information within his own consciousness and in his own mind pointed it in the direction of the faith to which he held allegiance. Now, what are the elements that we can definitely trace? A few of them. For it is in this rite that we have the Hierophant standing in the midst of the seven candlesticks, holding the jewel of stars, girdled in white, with a two-edged sword coming from his mouth. This emblem is taken directly from one of the earlier systems of religion. The Last Judgment is Egyptian. And the ritual of the psychostasia, of the weighing of the soul, is certainly derived from the Egyptian rite. The small stone upon which is written the name which none may read but the one to whom it is given is borrowed directly from the Greek rites of Eleusis. For it was in this rite that the patrona, or small stone bearing the name of the candidate, was used, and its symbolism explained and identify. The four horsemen of the Apocalypse most certainly refer to the four yugas of Hindu philosophy, that follow each other like the Greek ages of gold and silver, bronze and iron. All of these symbolisms can be traced without great difficulty to their original sources. Now, there's been a strong tendency in the last 200 or 300 years to attempt to interpret the Apocalypse as a prophetic work relating to the descent of nations and kingdoms and the attempt to identify the various beasts and monsters of that book with kingdoms and nations and empires of the historical world. I think that this is a wrong interpretation. I do not think the original author had such a concept because he was also a millennialist. He did not expect the world to last another 100 years. His predictions and prophecies dealt with a symbolism within himself. And this symbolism is an effort to unfold the mysteries of the universe as they were understood and known in his time. Two possibilities develop in connection with the study of the Apocalypse. Either that these visions themselves were highly symbolic, that in dreams and visions, which could be explained perhaps today on the level of analytical psychology, the scribe faintly reported that which had appeared in his inner consciousness. The second possibility here, that he himself created or applied symbolism to conceal or to partly reveal meanings, and that he was consciously and intentionally drawing symbolic pictures to conceal the actual facts which he wished to secretly perpetuate. Both of these concepts have some merit. Certainly we know that the story of the Apocalypse is based upon the Greek and early Latin concept of the universe as preserved in the phenomenon of Eratus of Soli and the sphere of Manilius. Eratus of Soli, who was one of the great astronomers, his work was evidently known to St. Paul because he is the only pagan author quoted by St. Paul, and the line, "and we are his children," is taken from Eratus of Soli. The Eratus concept of the universe was what we know today as the geocentric concept. And the revelation of John creates a series of symbolism involving this concept. The universe is divided into three sections, of which the lowest is elementary, consisting of the spheres of the four elements, earth, fire, air, and water, represented by the cherub of Ezekiel and by the mysterious Merkaba of ancient Jewish mysticism. Above, the orbits or levels of the elements are the orbits of the seven planets, as represented by Eratus of Soli. In this system, the sun occupied the fourth orbit, and the orbits consisted of those of the moon, Mercury, Venus, the sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. These were the seven planets known to the ancients. Above and outside of these was the great wall of heaven, the firmament, which was itself divisible into three distinguishable layers, of which definitions are left to us partly by philosophers as early as Pythagoras, and finally coordinated and integrated by Ptolemy of Alexandria. These three were called moved upon each other, these three orbits beyond the planets, and were called the firmament or the celestial orbits, or the first motions of the stars, for it was here that the fixed stars had their throne. Beyond and above the orbits of the fixed stars was a wall encircling the entire solar system, which was held within a sphere represented by the Egyptians by the use of the symbolism of a transverse section of an onion. These were concentric rings surrounded by a wall or shell, like the shell of an egg. And outside of that shell, beyond the sphere of the fixed stars was the empyrean, or the heaven world. And this, in this heaven world was the celestial city of the eternal God. And this city was on the shores of the Shemayim. And the Shemayim was the water which is above the firmament, or the crystal sea, which is described in the Apocalypse. For it says in Genesis that the waters which are above the firmament were divided from the waters which are beneath the firmament. And the Shemayim was the superior water of heaven, or the water of life, which flowed forever from the throne of the Eternal. And here, surrounded by the mysterious symbols of the cherubim, on a great and golden throne, before which knelt 24 elders, was the Eternal Spirit of God, and in the presence of God was the Lamb. And the Lamb had seven horns and seven eyes. And the whole symbolism is distinctly in line with the Mithraic rites of Persia and certain of the mysteries of the Greeks as set forth by the various Neoplatonists a little later. And of the Neoplatonists, particularly Iamblichus, in his discussion of the universe, and Porphyry in his Cave of the Nymphs, which was a study of the submundane universe. Now this remarkable concept becomes the great key to the Apocalypse. And as you study it more carefully, you begin to recognize that John's vision consisted of his ascending a ladder, a mysterious ladder of seven rungs, representing the orbits of the seven planets. And these planets were also the seven churches in Asia. And each of these planets can definitely be identified with the names and attributes of the seven churches. These planets and the churches are also the seven seals of the revelation, which must be opened. And to an Eastern student, the seven seals certainly tie very closely with the seven disciplines of Ananda and Yoga, the seals by means of which the conscious powers of the seer could be quickened and opened. And when John had ascended through the orbits of the seven planets, he came to the little door in heaven through which he passed through into the empyrean and beheld the mystery of the universe. A parallel of earlier days is the story of this star at the seven gates and her descent into the underworld to rescue Thammuz, who had died and was imprisoned by the god of the moon in the sublunary region. A little later, the apocryphal description of Muhammad's night journey to heaven contains a much parallel information. Riding upon a mysterious monster, part man, part horse, and part bird, called Al-Borak, the flash of lightning, Muhammad made the night journey and arrived upon this mount in his dream, which carried him to the stone Moriah on the threshing floor of the ancient Temple of Solomon. And here on the ancient threshing floor of the Jebusite, Muhammad alighted from the mysterious beast that carried him and stood in prayer waiting. And as he prayed, a ladder of silken cords fell from heaven. And Muhammad ascended the ladder and passed through each of the seven gates. And at each gate was one of the prophets. And when Muhammad reached the sixth gate, there was Jesus. But, of course, in the good terms of the Quran, for the Muslim, only Muhammad could pass the seventh gate. But the same allegory, the same symbolism, the signification of the ascent of consciousness through seven levels to internal seership, all of this is clearly indicated in the Apocalypse. Thus, we have reason to assume something which up to the present time has not been assumed by the majority of Christian scholars, namely that it is very likely and possible that an apocalyptic brotherhood or order existed at that time, In other words, as early as the first century, there was a secret doctrine in Christendom. A doctrine that differs from that of the traditional belief. This would be all the more reasonable because it already existed in the Jewish beliefs, and Christianity at that time would certainly have been influenced by the Jewish division of learning. As the Jewish doctrine had an inner mystical and an outer legal code, so Christianity might very well, and probably did possess, an outer historical and an inner apocalyptical mystery. We know that scenes from the apocalypse were performed in the early as the 3rd and 4th century as theatrical productions. And it is most likely that this work, that much like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, was originally a ritual used in the communication of certain secret teachings. Here we have also supporting influence from the Gnosis. And Gnostic Christianity has been pressed back by the recent discoveries near Telamara in Egypt and is now known to be much earlier than was originally thought, particularly its religious books. Part of the books of the Savior and the Mystic Sophia contain these discourses given in secret by Jesus only to certain selected disciples and immediate followers. And we have an authority for that, even in the Gospels, where it is said that Jesus taught the multitude in parables, but to his disciples he taught certain other things. What those other things are, the Gospels do not tell us. But the pseudo-Gospels and the Gnostic writings affirm that these things which he taught were the true secrets of his faith. And that these true secrets, as unfolded by the Gnostic Gospels, are exceedingly reminiscent of the apocalyptical story. Because they are presented much in the same spirit of high fantasy and symbolism. They are presented as wonderful mystical experiences of consciousness. Thus the apocalypse may very well, like the book of Genesis, have at one time been used as a ritual. The precedent for that is also in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, for we know definitely that this was used in the mysteries. As Dr. Preston told me in Chicago, that a papyrus of the Book of the Dead has been found, on the margins of which are the prompter's marks for the actors. So we know that the production was dramatized. And we have every reason to assume that as the apocalypse consists of a dozen or more segments from other faiths that were dramatized in their originals, that the entire work might be intended to be dramatized as a great syncretic document, leading to the Gnostic and later the Neoplatonic conviction that all these spiritual revelations were identical, and only the names were changed, and that there was only one great world doctrine of salvation. Plato sensed this, Paul acknowledged it, and it certainly could be interpreted as being a large part of the burden of the apocalypse. What the apocalypse means to the average person requires a fair understanding of Christianity as it existed in the close of the Ante-Nicene period. We've already mentioned the Great Council of Nicaea, which resulted in the gradual establishment of the canon. But prior to this period, we know, as I have said, that the boundaries of the faith were indistinct, and that therefore a number of other beliefs and doctrines were imposed upon it, to become so completely identical with it that it is almost impossible to distinguish the various degrees of originality. We may, however, definitely assume from the Gnosis and from other early sources for example, that it was not until about the years A.D. 60 that the followers of this new faith were called Christians. And that was only one mention of it. It occurred once, and known to have been so used. Not before and not again for more than 100 years. This one reference, therefore, indicates an important point, but does not establish a solution to our problem. Otherwise, the entire group was always referred to as the group of the Nazarenes. The original name of the Christian communion was the Nazarenes. The Nazarenes were therefore held in some ill repute because of the fact that that group and that area had been notable for the production of visionaries, mystics, and those of doubtful orthodoxy under the Jewish law. The Nazarene communion, therefore, was a Jewish communion with progressive, somewhat non-Jewish ideas. These ideas took greater and greater form until finally they broke away. But that break was not completed even during the lifetime of Paul. It comes considerably later. But the breaking away was continuing. Now we know that at that time, these churches or communions were so isolated and so far removed from each other that undoubtedly some of them were totally lost. Gradually, the various faiths of the area absorbed them. But in so doing, absorbed also some of their ideas. So that we had a number of schismatic groups representing minglings of Christian and non-Christian beliefs in various proportions. If the Christian proportion dominated, the group was simply heretical. If the Christian proportion did not dominate at all, then the group remained essentially pagan. But there were many levels and degrees of the Christian communion at that time. Now let us, for the purpose of our general survey of our purpose and our picture, go back now and attempt to make a composite picture out of the entire subject of this series of talks, so that we will take away something that makes a story. We have discussed the Pentateuch, by which the Jewish law was established, under the Torah or the books of Moses. But this law, essentially, was the law of a monotheistic deism, a law which declared that the law of God and the law of man were identical. And that the entire system of Jewish life, personal, religious, economic, industrial, historical, was based upon the religious concepts and writings. That the Torah, or the law, was followed by a great unfoldment. And that this unfoldment developed through the application of the laws to the psychological emergency of the Jewish nation, which gradually developed and resulted in the development of the prophetic and mystical writings, which we now associate with the patriarchs and the prophets. That in turn, the entire story gradually took upon itself a mystical atmosphere, and the emergencies and needs of the Jewish soul in bondage, the tremendous pressures of persecution on the outside, the intense distress due to uncertainty of how their God could leave them naked to their enemies, resulted gradually in the rise of a strong mystical tradition in Israel, a tradition which was consummated later in the Kabbalah and the Mishnah. And that this mystical tradition has as its most complete unfoldment the story of King Solomon's temple and the building of the universal house of mankind. We then move into the New Testament pattern, where we contact, first of all, the Gospels as we know them. And here we find a strong and powerful revision of the Torah. we find the emergence of a teacher known to Christianity as Jesus of Nazareth, known probably to the Talmud as Jehoshua ben Pantera, a man who attempted not to go against the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them, and who taught a powerful doctrine developed from the sources of the Nazarene and the Essenes. But this man's great message was liberation of Israel by the transference of the weight of value from the success in this world to the storing up of treasures in an eternal world, where thieves could not break in and where rust would not destroy. So we have from the great sorrow of man the emergence of the man of sorrow. We find the great need for spiritual consolation in the Near East, producing from itself a tremendous regenerating force, a force exemplified by a king of the Jews whose kingdom was not of this world. A reference perhaps to the great expectation, the great hope, that which suffers and fails in this world, if it is still true to its principles, will live on to glory. But there that the burdens which we carry and for which we see no release prepare us for a better life than we have ever known. This was the burden of the beginning of this concept. And all through this, we are dealing with one package. We are dealing with the package of the struggle of Israel, its struggle through bondage, its struggle through the captivities, its struggle against Rome, and finally the crushing defeat of Israel, the fall of the kingdom of Judea, and the diaspora, or the scattering of Israel, and the end of the political, social identity of this people. In this critical moment, when the worst had happened, when the entire background of Judaism was falling away from those who were passing through this great tribulation, we find the arising of the second act of the drama which ties together the whole picture of the Old and New Testament. This second act is the introduction of the character of St. Paul. Here we have a man by race Jewish, by station a Roman, by learning a Greek. We have a man in whose nature many streams of concept and belief mingle. We find this man stepping into a situation. He stepped into it probably out of emergency. He was convinced that the disciples did not have the vision of the significance of the life of Jesus. He was also convinced that this life of Jesus was not even in itself the significant thing, that there was something else, and that this something else was revealed in one single incredible instant in the Theophany. That there was a power in the universe, the Logos, that in the twinkling of an eye could make all things new. That there was in space a tremendous redeeming power. And that this redeeming power, this inevitable that could step in and change all things and make all sickness well again, that this tremendous redeeming power was actually the love of God. And that this love of God was conjured into existence by love for God. And this perhaps was St. Paul's great consolation. For when he persecuted the Christians, he did it for love of his God. Therefore, actually love suffered long in his kind. And this mystery of the reward for devotion, even if it is misplaced, seemed to have struck Paul desperately with great earnestness and importance. And as a result of that, he became conscious of a universal good, a universal reality. We which he may have already sensed in free Christian studies in other schools and systems. Perhaps he also realized that this power that had come to him had been previously reported of men like Pythagoras, that these divine men were divine because of a tremendous divine power moving through them. He experienced this power. And in the experiencing of it, he discovered that neither words nor symbols were adequate, that nothing could be done except this tremendous, complete acceptance, and that this, in some mysterious way, was the true Christianity, that this was the lesson that Jesus sought to teach, but which the disciples did not understand. They saw him, Jesus, as a man. Paul saw him as a mystery. And that this mystery was actually the mystery of the love of God. And that it was this love of God that sustained Jesus and made possible to him the complete sacrifice of his life for that divine love. And that the Christian, therefore, or one Christ, is one in whose spirit, soul, and understanding abideth now these three, hope, faith, and love. And the greatest of these is love. Now, in the old Bible, they use the word charity. But this is from charitas, which actually means not to give somebody something, but to cherish. And is another form of the word love. So that love, rather than charity, is a correct translation of the original. And so Paul experienced in the theophany the sudden and immediate and complete unquestioned love of life. Love of this mysterious thing which had overwhelmed him with its mercy and overwhelmed him with its love even while he hated. And out of this came the dream that Paul attempted to expand through his great missionary journeys and through his preaching to the whole world. He taught that wisdom was not so important, but the important thing was the simple and complete act of religious love. That in some mysterious way, love releases. And that which it releases is God's love in all things. And so Paul sought to teach an experience in God, a lifting up in the Spirit. For if this love of God in man is lifted up, it will draw all things unto it. And this love is the second logos, the heart of God. And God redeems his world by sending forth his love into the world. And this love took flesh and was born among men. And men did not receive it, did not know it, did not understand it. But to such as did understand, he was given the blessing and the boon of eternal life. And Paul believed firmly and definitely that this love power comes not to man, but through man, because of its abidance within his own nature. Paul, who working from the Greek angle of philosophy, recognizing a God in man, declared man's own purified and regenerated love to be the only begotten of his own Godhood. And that as God had created him, so love would perfect and redeem him. So all things that were created by wisdom and strength were perfected by love. And therefore, that love, in a spiritual sense, is the Savior, the Regenerator, and the Redeemer of all life. This was the burden and substance of his message. But he had so many trials, so many tribulations, so many wars and struggles with his churches, with his communion, and with the backsliding members of his group, that always he is extolling. Always he is entreating, always he is demanding. But under it all is this vast concept of the creative, redemptive power of sincere, unselfish love of God, manifested always and forever through man's love of man. Thus love became to him more important than any other form of wisdom. And he considered it the perfect wisdom that man should love perfectly all things. And when man turned his love inward toward the contemplation of God, and experienced through love God's presence within himself, then he too had a theophany, for he beheld the love of God advancing to him out of the mysterious dimensions of his own soul, as Paul beheld a vision upon the road to Damascus. Now Paul, having conceived this tremendous structure of the Christian mystery of a universal power of redemption, a power inherent in God from the beginning of time, a power which through the love of God, incidentally, reserved all peoples prior to the advent of Christ. For up to that time, all good men were saved for the love of God. And because of God's infinite love, no good man who did not know the way of Christ could be lost. This was an important doctrine of the early church that was forgotten all too soon. And out of this also then arises the consummation, or the third act of this mysterious and wonderful tragedy and drama, and that is the unfoldment of the apocalyptical vision. For in the apocalyptical part, we see or dimly perceive the outlines of the great scientific mystical structure, which was lacking in the Gospels and not evident in the Pauline epistles. Here we suddenly see beneath the robes and garments of the faith, the structure of bones and nerves and arteries and veins, by means of which this thing was a living body. And this living body consisted of the presence and existence of a discipline, of a system secretly derived from the great religions of the world, whereby the unfoldment of man and the perfection of his nature and the enlightenment of his service of universal love could be achieved. And I think that our basic concept there could be clarified by the simple statement that Jesus admonished all his people and his children to love one another. Paul taught men to love Christ, or the universal principle of love. But it remained for the apocalypse to define love. Here was the thing that was missing. We have all tried to love. We have tried to love on a human level, and we have tried to love on a religious level, but we are somewhat confused. We do not know what love is. We perhaps learn most of it in moments when we most forget ourselves in the service of others. But still, the perfection of love, the direction of its full measure and intensity upon those things totally worthy, demands the same that we have in the Orient and in other parts of the world, and that is the development of a great system of discrimination, that we may choose the right, and that we may have the courage, the strength, the wisdom, and the understanding to know what is right, even though we desire unselfishly to serve and preserve the right. We must all, as Lincoln said, serve the right as it is given to us to know the right. But the disciplines of the apocalypse remind us that there is a way by which the individual, through internal development, can come into the conscious knowledge of God's will, and therefore attain the consciousness of obedience. That up to that time, men see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. And this is, of course, the difference in the ancient rites between the mystai and the epotai. In the Grecian mysteries, the lesser rites, the candidate, was placed before a veil through which he could dimly see the altar of the young. In this time were those, therefore, or the mystics who saw through a mist or through an obscuration. But the apotai were those who saw face to face from whom the veil had been removed. And this, of course, is again a rather definite indication that Paul was acquainted with the rites of the Eleusinian mysteries. But in the Apocalypse, we find the story and the study of the complete internal mystery of human regeneration, set forth in the strange symbolical sciences of the ancient religious rites. Thus we find in the Apocalypse that which is necessary to complete the system. And that, of course, is the exact way by which an end can be accomplished. In the Gospels, we have Christianity as a religion. In the Epistles, we have Christianity as a philosophy. And in the Apocalypse, where is the last place you would ever expect to find it, you have Christianity as a science. But the science is concealed in symbols, in secret language, in order that the rules, because they are inevitable and inflexible, if properly used, will not pass into the keeping of those who are unworthy. So the more exact the system, the more completely it is hidden by symbols. But in the Apocalypse, we have the story of the internal transformation of human consciousness, just as surely as we have it in the Uttara Gita and in the great commentaries of Yoga and Vedanta. Thus we have in the Christian situation a complete picture, a picture which derives its cosmogony originally from the Old Testament, its anthropology from the New Testament, and its psychology the prophetic writings of both Testaments. We have the story of the gradual building up of the great syncretic doctrine, a doctrine which must sometimes be re-unfolded or brought back again into the understanding and knowledge of men by painstakingly reversing the system by means of which it was obscured. This means that through the study of comparative religion, we are coming into a fuller understanding of biblical meaning. It means, therefore, that through the mingling of various religions of the East and West, through the increasing understanding of East-West religious and philosophical indebtedness, little by little, the concept of a great coming world religion begins to emerge. And this is the concept that was lurking in the soul of St. Paul. And that is that in the great religion of mankind, we would find the mystery of the absolute religious identity of love. That love in all faiths is the same. And that love of God is the supreme faith and the common denominator of all worship. And therefore, that those who worship true love are the servants of the Logos. And this Logos is called in Christendom the Christos, or the Anointed One. It is also the Maitreya of Buddhism. It is desired before all nations. It is Ahmed, the mysterious Messiah to come of Islam. It is any and all things that relate to the preservation and salvation of the world through good. Because in love, the elevated, raised up to the first place among all things, it will draw all men unto it. And in the simple and tremendous exposition of a doctrine of salvation through the available love of God, manifested through love for God and man, we have the complete statement of a mystical experience. This was the experience which Paul felt. This was the experience that he could only put into the words of his time and place. But he knew that it was timeless and placeless. He sensed that. And by that sensing, he gave us the beginnings of a greater possibility for the Christian faith. And he also gave the world a faith that could grow and would survive 20 centuries. A faith which in turn must continue to grow until it reveals from itself that which is its great secret, namely Christ in a mystery. And that mystery is universal love as the panacea of all the world's woes. And the new heaven and the new earth, the Son of Man coming in glory. For this Son of Man who is to rule over and redeem the 144,000 of the saved represents love, which is the firstborn of the God in man, and the firstborn God-man in the world. Thus love to Paul was the Logos, the power which took creation and perfected it, which brought it back again, fulfilling the mysterious curse of Eden, making possible the resurrection of the spirit and the flesh. And even today we know that the very sick flesh has been resurrected by love alone. And so love suffereth long in its time, and it fulfills its works, and it achieves all things, and it comes in glory to rule all men in the day of the great transformation. And this is the secret of peace, which is Paul's answer, but the final solution to all things is that when men should love one another, in that day the golden age is reborn. That is the millennium. And it does not come because men have not attained it. It cannot come until it comes as it did fall through a mystery in the Spirit. Through something that happens along the long road of life. A vision. A sudden stroke in darkness. A sudden voice speaking out of the pathway which we follow. A voice calling us to a higher destiny. The Paul's life is itself highly symbolical. Man's resistance to truth and his final acceptance of it. And in the complete picture of the Bible, therefore, we have two great pillars, the law and love. The greatest of these is love. And in the old dispensation, we have the dispensation of a universe ruled by sovereign law. The new dispensation, the universe ruled by love. But not a love that breaks the law, but a love that fulfills the law. A love in man which makes him realize that the law is lovable, and that all things which the law demands of man, he should graciously bestow of himself by love of God, so that man by love learns to obey, and in so doing, the law is transformed into grace. This, it seems, is the burden of the story. And more time and thought can be expended upon it. But this is the best we can do with you in the time that we have. And we thank you very much for being with us for this series and hope that you have found it worthwhile.